From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the binary star system with Walter Cruttenden. And also a couple of birthdays. They're both in St. Louis. Renowned sculptor Don Wiegand and Matt Birkenmeyer. Happy birthday, you two. Enjoy. Here's what's happening. I'm not going to say I told you so, but a patient being treated at a Dallas hospital is the first person diagnosed with Ebola in the United States. Now, the unidentified man left Liberia on September 19th, arrived in the United States on the 20th. Citing privacy concerns, health officials are declining to release much information about the patient and how he contracted the virus or how he is being treated at this point. Gary Ridenour, of course, expert on infectious diseases, his book, Pandemic. Gary, you and I were just talking about this last week.
We were. I hate to be right on something like this, but we were both right on this call. The World Health Organization, the CDC, they look like the dance band on the Titanic right now. Safety protocols are in place, no problem. This man developed symptoms on the 24th of September, and on the 26th, he went to a local hospital, and they couldn't put it together that it was a black man from Liberia who was very sick, that maybe he had Ebola, and they sent him home. And then 2 days later, on the 28th, he was finally admitted with a provisional diagnosis of Ebola. And the question is, was he infectious on the planes? It scares you. ZMapp, the antibody that you'd use on these kind of people, it's not available. They can't make any more of it or something, or it doesn't work. Who knows? But this is very, very frightening that somebody could get through. And, you know, you can have a fever and keep throwing handfuls of aspirin in and keep drinking lots of fluids and get by these supposed health personnel taking your temperature.
They have no way of catching that.
I don't know if he even was seen by anybody.
Though it's not airborne, at least they say this, Gary, how would you like to be the poor person sitting next to this person?
Oh, yeah, well, how would you like to be the next person that got on the plane and sat in that seat?
Oh, geez.
You know, and then the person after that. And it just, you know, it would just multiply across the country. This is very, very scary. And the CDC said it's a fluid dynamic situation. And that's my definition of disaster.
So far, 3,000 people, West Africa, have died from this latest Ebola outbreak. Here in the United States, all right, we have this one case. Let's see what happens, see if they cure this individual. It's pretty scary, though, Gary.
It is, and the problem is that in Guinea, 2 days ago, a local journalist and some healthcare workers were going to a small village to tell them how to wash their hands and things, and the people threw rocks at them and made them run out and leave the village. So they went to another village for safety, and all nine of them were beaten to death by the local villagers because they believed these were the devils that carried the virus around.
Gary's website, pandemicdirect.com. Gary, thank you. As we reported about the possibility of Ebola eventually coming to the United States, and not just by treating patients, but this is the first patient ever to be diagnosed with Ebola in the United States. The mayor of a city near Los Angeles County, here in California, shot and killed tonight. The wife of Bell Gardens Mayor Daniel Crespo has been detained. He was married his high school sweetheart in 1986. He's been married ever since. The couple has a son and a daughter. Pro-democracy crowds have stayed on the streets of Hong Kong at the start of National Day, which activists hope will see the largest protest so far. Tens of thousands of people have been blocking parts of the city for days. They are demanding that China withdraw plans to vet candidates for the next leadership election, and that's going to be held in 2017. Those folks in Hong Kong want democracy. They're not giving up. China's not backing down. See what happens. The U.S. consumer confidence fell in September for the first time in 5 months, and home prices in July rose less than expected from a year earlier, underscoring the unsteady nature of the U.S. growth. Let's check in with investment advisor Catherine Austin Fitz, who heads up Solari.com and also financialpermaculture.com. Catherine, your opinion of the fourth quarter that we're going into.
George, the economy is really struggling, and one of the causes is, you know, this is the time when the harvest comes in. And I'm out in California right now, and things are tough. The wheat production's down by 40%. Corn is down by 45%. And if you look across all the crops, it's major, major problems coming from the drought. So I think part has been we had the cold weather, and now we have drought and serious problems with the harvest. But all across the country, you see real struggling. Part of it is the regulatory beatdown. I don't know if you saw the story today, but as many as 300,000 people could lose or have to give back their subsidies under Obamacare.
Yeah, I saw that story. So, Catherine, in this particular case,
hurt your economics.
With the economy just kind of like stagnant right now, people are expecting, you know, fourth quarter for retailers especially, this is supposed to be the time of the year. Is it going to happen?
I don't know. There are things that could turn this around. I just think that the American middle class has gotten so squeezed and is really struggling, and I don't see how we get out of that by Christmas time, George.
Catherine's website, Solari.com, is part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Microsoft has disclosed the first details of Windows 10 in its next operating system. Those of you who love computers, the name is a surprise, keeping in mind that it represents a jump from the last version, Windows 8. What happened to 9? The software will run on a wide range of devices, from phones and tablets to PCs, the Xbox game consoles, with applications sold from a single store. NASA's plans to work on two new commercial spacecraft faced a delay following a formal protest about the contract award process. You might remember that Boeing and SpaceX got the contract. They're going to divvy up the money and build these. The complaint has been filed by an eliminated contender, Sierra Nevada Corporation. They're not happy. They say they're $900 million under the Boeing bid. Let's see what happens there. NASA's Cassini spacecraft has discovered a mysterious feature on Saturn's moon Titan. The story's at coasttocoastam.com. Scientists are determined to find out exactly what this might be. NASA reports that the feature is roughly 100 square miles in one of Titan's hydrocarbon seas. Cassini's radar has observed the feature twice, but its appearance changed between the two sightings. So they're baffled. Let's check in with astronomer Stephen Cates. Dr. Sky, are you baffled, Stephen?
Absolutely, George, but I think we should set the stage by saying the Cassini spacecraft has really done a wonderful job in imaging this particular satellite. And let's remind the audience that Titan is actually the second largest satellite, George, in the entire solar system, some 3,200 miles in diameter. Where the Cassini spacecraft has imaged these pictures is in a sea called Ligia Madre. Now, get a load of this, folks. In the polar regions, and George, on the poles of this particular satellite, we see these methane lakes. This one's larger than Lake Superior. The only larger one on the surface of Titan is a place called Kraken Mare, bigger than the Caspian Sea. But here's the interesting part, George. Most of these seas, again, it's the only other satellite in the solar system where liquid material is floating on the surface that we know of, probably methane. But my guess, like many of the other folks out there, is that we're seeing some dynamic changes inside these particular lakes. Who knows what's really going on deep below the surface? But the important thing is, remember, methane, ethane, and then there's that thing that we run our vehicles on called octane. It'd be kind of awesome in a science fiction way if we could transport that material to Earth. Good luck with that. But George, you can still see Saturn low into the sky. For folks that want to take a look with a telescope, you will see the satellite Titan. It's that big, just off the edge of the moon of the planet itself. And George, as we move into October, it is so exciting. We talked a couple of weeks ago, a total lunar eclipse coming up in about a week, a solar eclipse, and then on the 19th of October, this amazing event, Comet Sighting Spring.
Wow.
Is going to get so close to Mars, about 81,000 miles. Some are saying that the coma may even affect the atmosphere of the planet. And don't forget, there's the Orionid meteor shower. So, George, always great stuff for people to check at drsky.com.
You got it.
And our photo and aviation site, photorecon.net. great month coming, so it look to the skies.
Now we know why they call you Dr. Sky. He makes it exciting, doesn't he? A Texas man suspected of stealing a casket to play a prank on his sister by making her think that he had dug up their dead father has been arrested after she called police. They are charging him with stealing an empty casket out of a hearse. Not funny. Well, the FBI came out with a report on mass public shootings, but John Lott says there's some misrepresentation there. And we're also going to talk with John with his new book, Dumbing Down the Courts. Have you ever been in court? You're going to share some of your stories with us later on as well. John Lott is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. John Lott, president of the newly formed Crime Prevention Research Center. He's an economist. He has held research and teaching positions at places like the University of Chicago, Yale University, Stanford, UCLA. John was the chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission during the 1988 and 89 era, and is the author of also More Guns, Less Crime, Freedonomics, The Bias Against Guns, and his latest, Dumbing Down the Courts. Hey, John, welcome back.
Great to talk to you again, George.
John, tell us a little bit about the Crime Prevention Research Center. What is that?
Well, it's a group of academics, people that I've gotten to know in my many years in academia, who are interested in a lot of issues on crime, but in particular on gun control. And they're worried that a lot of misinformation is being put out there. I mean, you have people like Michael Bloomberg, who's spending $50 million a year now, you know, in addition to other money he's been putting into research. You have people like Soros and even President Obama's putting a lot of federal money into it. You have reports like this FBI report that I guess we'll get into that you just mentioned, where he's using federal resources to put out really disingenuous information. And so the academics that I'm working with, and we have a very prestigious board of academic advisors, just want to try to get the facts out. People who have worked for decades in these areas, and we want to use our expertise to try to offset a lot of the misinformation and fear that's being put out there.
Lots going on these days, John, and people, of course, always concerned about their guns. Lots of strange stories now, the beheading in Oklahoma, a real estate agent in Little Rock disappeared, and they found her dead today. Just strange things, but you know, the beheading story was interesting to me because his boss had a gun and was able to take this guy out before he probably would have injured other people.
Right. Well, he was in the process of, looked like, beheading a second person. Had basically stabbed them and mobilized them, and it looked like he was about ready to cut off this other woman's head when the executive there, who had a gun with him, he's a part-time reserve sheriff, but he also has a concealed handgun permit, was able to go and stop the attack there. And, you know, that aspect of the story got relatively little attention.
I've been looking at stories, John, where some pretty notable people, they've been experts, they teach school districts various crime prevention measures. Some of them have been coming out talking about the mass shooting at Sandy Hook, where so many youngsters were reportedly killed, and they say it never happened. They say the whole thing was a staged event, that nobody got hurt. And then they cite an FBI report that showed that nobody died in Newton during that time period. Now, I'm baffled by this. I don't understand this.
Yeah, well, it's pretty bizarre that anybody would think that. I mean, it's very clear that people died. I mean, you just have to go and listen to the anguish of the parents and others and relatives of people who died. I mean, it's kind of hard to believe that they're going to literally get, you know, thousands of people who are related directly or indirectly to a lot of these people to go and make up some type of story. And, you know, the emotional trauma. I mean, I've talked to people who have lost relatives in the Newtown tragedy there. And it hasn't for even one millisecond even crossed my mind that somehow this was a staged event. I mean, this is general. You talk to people there. I mean, look, as part of my research over the years, I've ended up talking to a lot of people who have been present at these attacks as well as relatives. And You know, people go through trauma for years after, even those who live through the event. They have nightmares. They have essentially PTSD-type symptoms afterwards. And the notion that these people who are going through this trauma, as I say, even the ones who lived, that somehow is made up is just bizarre.
What is the latest with your work? We're going to get into dumbing down the courts in a second here, John, but back to this FBI report. And you wrote the FBI's misrepresentation of the change in mass public shootings. The FBI has said that mass shootings are on the increase, and you think otherwise. Tell me why.
Right. Well, they say it's not only on the increase, but if you've seen the charts in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or whatever, they indicate a huge, massive increase, they claim, since 2000. They say that the number of fatalities have increased annually at about a 16% rate, and the number of attacks have also increased at a 16% rate. There's so many problems with this. First of all, I'd say over 40% of these cases are not what one would call mass shootings. They have either no one killed or injured in the attacks, or they have at most one person harmed. Now, those are troublesome cases, but they're not what we normally think of mass shootings. So that's 40% of the cases, but the important thing is that most of those 40% occur at the very end of the period. And so by putting in these kind of non-mass shooting cases, it makes it look like there's a bigger increase over time than there actually is. And then there's a really puzzling thing that goes on here, and that is, even though they're including these cases where no one was killed or injured in the attacks, they're actually missing a number of cases where at least two or more people were killed in attacks. They're missing cases where four people have been killed. And the ones that they're missing are all from the very early part of the period. I have an appendix in our report that I sent to you that just lists these things. And the thing is, by not including what are clear cases in the earlier part of the period, it makes it look like it's lower there than it actually is. And that also makes it look like there's a bigger increase over time than there actually is. And then the third general point is that they picked 2000 to start this. Now, anybody who works in this area knows that 2000, 2001 tend to be very low years. If you look at the last 40 years in terms of mass shootings, they tend to be about the lowest years that we've had attacks. And so what I try to do, because of past work that I've done, I have collected data on mass shootings since 1977 in great detail. And if you go back and look over that whole period of time from 77 through 2014, then you find essentially no change, no statistically significant change over that entire period of time. And so, you know, surely these guys know this stuff. I mean, they deal with this type of data all the time. And so the fact that they ignored all this earlier data, there's no explanation for why they started counting them when they did. And you know, to me, unfortunately, it kind of represents the politicization of the FBI. I mean, this is not the type of kind of data manipulation that you'd like to see happen. I mean, to me, it's just a major story that they can miss 20 cases of mass shootings where at least two people have been killed in public places that fit their definition that's there very clearly. I just don't know how they could miss those cases.
Well, it's probably intentional. I don't think you could miss those cases, you know, without making a mistake. I think they probably plan to do that.
You know, it's part of this, our mission for the Crime Prevention Research Center is to try to go through some of this type of evidence. There's another report that we have coming out this week on Michael Bloomberg with his studies that he's been putting out. I have to say, I've looked at all the studies that have come out from Bloomberg over the last 2 years, and they all have really serious errors in it. It's just amazing to me that they had a report that we finally got around to from July looking at mass shootings and the mistakes that they make. I mean, my 12-year-old daughter, I would hope, the type of mistakes that they make. They don't record the ages of the shooters, right? I mean, anything from trivial stuff, like whether or not the person had mental illness to begin with. They go and make this claim that 84% of shootings have occurred where guns are allowed.
Blunders everywhere, John. Hey, John, we're going to take this break. We'll come right back. We'll talk more about this and your new work, Dumbing Down the Courts. If you've ever been in a court, well, what do you think it's like? We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, John Lott with us. Dumbing Down the Courts, John. You know, a lot of people who've been in the court system walk out with their head shaking, frustrated. What's going on with the court system?
Well, I had been concerned about how the confirmation battle seemed to be getting more ferocious over time. I mean, everybody kind of knows about Bork's confirmation hearings, but in general, that's just kind of the tip of the surface. If you look at the appeals court judges or district court judges, there's been a steady increase in terms of how long it's taken judges to get confirmed, and also the confirmation rates, how they have fallen. And I wanted to, first of all, just try to explain why that was increasing. But when I was starting to look at the data, I realized that it wasn't just across the board that nominees were having the most difficult times. It was the very smartest nominees, the ones who had gone to the top law schools, the ones who had done the very best in their classes, the ones who had stellar records both before they were on the court and when they did end up getting on the courts, that had by far the most difficult times getting confirmed. I'll just give you one example. If you are an appeals court nominee who went to a top 10 law school, graduated in the top 10% of your class, and then clerked for an appeals court judge and the Supreme Court judge, it took you about 167% longer to get through the confirmation process than somebody who didn't go to a top law school, didn't do particularly well, didn't have any prestigious courtship clerkships. And this more successful, smarter person was actually about 40% less likely to end up getting confirmed. So they faced a much more difficult confirmation, and they were less likely to eventually get on the court.
And these are people, John, whether they're Court of Appeals justices or they're on the Supreme Court, they will determine the future of many, many Americans.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's hard to kind of get across to people how courts get into even the tiniest aspects of our lives. I mean, you have federal courts in just the last few years have determined issues of whether the federal government can determine whether or not somebody's able to be a minister in a church. You've had federal courts decide whether carbon dioxide, the very air that you exhale, is a pollutant. You have federal courts looking at things like whether the federal government can enable GPS devices, whether they're something they stick on your car or even the ones in your phone, to monitor civilians even without court orders. I mean, you could go on. You have something like, can a state put to death somebody who brutally tortures and then rapes a child? I mean, it's hard to think of something that courts don't get involved with these days. And so whether you have somebody who's able to go through the complex and ever increasingly complex regulations and figure out exactly what the implications of those things would be. You know, we care a lot about whether we have our best and brightest on the courts.
The Supreme Court justices, they basically stay till they die or they decide to quit, right?
Right.
They're almost like popes.
Yeah. Well, they used to retire a little bit earlier. It's interesting. People who get appointed to the Supreme Court have always had extremely long life expectancies. that really hasn't changed too much, but kind of how late they wait until they're near death has changed over the last couple decades, and they tend to hang on longer than they did before.
Now, when you looked at the court system, and I'm talking about all around the country as well, John, I mean, in little areas where judges are, you know, elected, even though most people who vote for the judges don't even know who they are, they just right. vote for them. Let's start from that level, too. I mean, what is that doing to this court system?
Well, I'm not really sure that there's a huge difference in terms of electing judges versus ones who get appointed. A lot of the difference tends to be over how long they end up serving. If you have somebody who's going to be on the court for 8 years or somebody who's going to be on the court for life, there's more at stake in some sense when the person's going to be on for a longer period of time, and so you see bigger battles. But there's one thing that's clearly changed, and it's changed more at the federal court level than it has at the state court level, and that's just been how the role of courts in our lives has increased over time. And, you know, 50, 60 years ago, the types of questions that we just listed wouldn't have been cases that federal courts would have likely heard. And so I just give you one measure. If you look at the number of cases in federal appeals courts, they've since 1960, they've gone up 12 times faster than the growth in the population. And so that gives you some idea of just how many more areas in people's lives the courts are involved with now than they were in 1960. And as more is at stake, people have fought more over who's going to be on the courts.
How biased are some of the judges, John?
Well, I mean, I think there's a range. There's interesting information that we have there on that, and that is you have surveys of lawyers who practice before federal judges, and we have that over many decades. There's a difference between Republicans and Democrats, obviously, but there's not a huge difference within parties. You see the big differences across parties as opposed to differences in views, the political biases of judges within parties. There's neither party puts on too many people that are kind of really outliers. Now, that's changed, I believe, a little bit in the last couple of years under the Obama administration. And part of that has to do with the fact that they no longer have the filibuster for judges. And so President Obama has nominated people who are kind of more left than you've seen in the past, even during his first term in office or under Clinton or Carter.
If you were up before and had the ability to have a jury or a judge, which would you pick?
Well, I think I'd probably go for a jury for many reasons. I think juries tend to be a little bit less politically biased, actually, than I think a lot of judges, particularly federal judges. For state judges, I guess it'd be not as much of a difference for me. But, you know, it's interesting. You bring up juries because I think it gives an example of what's going on. Have you ever served on a jury?
Never did. But, you know, being in the media, I've always been disqualified. You know, they
right.
Do.
Well, that's exactly the point I was going to bring up, because you obviously are a very smart, very persuasive guy. And if you were to be called up, you'd be struck because it's just not your vote. Lawyers on either side of the case would realize that you could go and persuade other jurors.
That's right.
So
that's
you're like 2, 3, 4, 5 votes,
yeah,
because of your ability to persuade people. And the same thing happens in terms of judges, that if you want to put somebody on the Supreme Court or on an appeals court, it's just not their views that you and your opponents care about. It's whether or not the person that you put on the court is going to be able to persuade other people on his panel.
Good point.
Or going to be able to go and write decisions that are going to go and influence other judges around the country. So just as you want to get somebody on the court that's going to be able to persuade other judges to change their mind and vote with him, your opponents are going to want to oppose that person. And that's related a lot to how smart these individuals are.
Well, in reality, John, the judges are supposed to make their decisions based on the law. But in
right.
many, many cases, they make their decisions based on their own interpretation of the law that sways their way.
Right. Well, I think it's probably more directly to say they make it on their political views rather than on what the law is. And it's really interesting how that's changed over time. if you go back to even you know, the Hoover administration or earlier, it's not uncommon to find Republicans appointing Democrats to the courts or Democrats appointing Republicans to the court. Herbert Hoover appointed in 1932 a person named Benjamin Cardozo. And the reason why he appointed him was he asked Republican lawyers and Democratic lawyers around the country, who is the brightest lawyer in the country? And a lot of them came back and said Cardozo. Now, Cardozo had campaigned against Hoover in 1928 and was a very staunch Democrat. But, you know, Hoover thought that judges would do what you said, and that is they would look at the law and they would pretty much just stick to what the law says there rather than go and insert their own personal opinion. But you look at something like guns, we're talking about guns. If you look at any of the appeals court cases that have been decided on guns, about 94% of the time you can guess how an appeals court judge is going to vote on a gun-related issue based upon their political affiliation. Just knowing their political affiliation will virtually always tell you which way they're going to vote on a gun control issue.
And will it ever change, John?
Well, I think it's going to get worse rather than better.
I agree.
And the reason is that the things that have caused this fight over who's going to be on the courts has been related to what the federal government does, the extent that the federal government has gotten involved in our lives. And I suppose if one believes that the federal government's going to keep getting more involved with regulations, and then who we care about who's going to be on the court is going to be even more contentious.
Unbelievable the way this happens. And I guess, you know, in with judges and justices in other countries, those that have judges, is it the same problem?
Well, I haven't really studied the data for other countries, but, you know, I think it's a pretty universal phenomenon. I just give you one simple example and with American politics just in general, and that is look about how much money is spent on political campaigns compared to how much was being spent 120 years ago or whatever. It's increased a huge amount. But there's I think there's a simple reason for that. When the federal government was 2 to 3% of GDP 100 years ago, people didn't really care as much who was elected. It didn't really matter as much. As the size of the federal government, not only in terms of spending, but also in terms of regulations, has ballooned, you see a corresponding increase in the amount of money that's spent on political campaigns. And I think, you know, the same type of phenomenon exists when you're talking about who gets to be a judge.
So in terms of the appointment of the justices, president appoints, the Congress, Senate and Congress, do approve? Is that how it works?
Right. Yeah, that's right. So you have, for all the federal judges, the president nominates somebody, and then it goes to the Senate, and the Senate votes the person either up or down. We've seen huge changes in the confirmation rates over time. If you look at Carter for appeals court judges, you're talking about something that was about 93%, and it pretty much consistently fell up through George W. Bush, you know, over the last decade, where it had gotten down to about 72%. So it went from about 93% down to 72% confirmation rates. Now, it's gone back up to over 90% under Obama, but that's in part been due to two things. One is he had essentially a supermajority in the Senate for a couple years, his first 2 years in office. And during his second term, they got rid of the ability for opponents to go and filibuster nominees. So, but, you know, when you had 60 votes in the Senate, there was really no way for Republicans to stop a nominee in that case. But, you know, prior to that, from Carter through Bush, you had seen a huge drop, a 20 percentage point drop in the confirmation rate for judges. And, you know, the numbers that I go through really underestimate the change in who would get nominated, because What you don't see there are people who refuse to even put their name in nomination. I have been taught at the University of Chicago Law School. I was at Yale Law School for a while. And so I know a number of prominent academics who had been kind of approached by White Houses about whether or not they'd put their name up for nomination. And the interesting thing is just how so many of really bright people would not even let their name be considered for nomination because they had seen what had happened to others. You know, you may have an average confirmation under George W. Bush's tenure for appeals court judges of a year, but that's on average. The very smartest ones you could find could last over 4 years, and essentially their life's on hold. You know, and the opponents will do whatever they can in order to try to make things miserable. Like every couple of weeks, they'll ask for new documents, make you have to re-specify documents that you'd already sent in. You know, they couldn't make public statements during that period of time. They weren't able to defend themselves against charges, some of them very, very mean charges, you know, claiming people are racist or whatever, that were there in order to try to personally destroy them because a lot was at stake. And just one other way to put this is if you compare it to appointments for, like, cabinet, you think cabinet, those are powerful positions. There should be real battles over those things. But you look over the last five presidencies, the length of confirmation battles between when the Senate gets it and when a vote occurs is almost always less than 20 days.
Yeah, I think the toughest one was Clarence Thomas, wasn't it?
Well, Bork was extremely long. Thomas was well over 100 days. You know, those are two of the toughest that you've had. You've had lengths of like 70 days for Obama's Dior and Kagan, though those quite a bit shorter than Thomas and Bork.
All right, John, we're going to take this break, and we're going to come back and chat with you about concealed weapons, guns, about judges. If you are a concealed weapons permit holder and you've had to use that, check in with us as well. John Lott, our special guest. John, give us your blog, would you?
Sure. Well, go to crimeresearch.org, and they can find a whole bunch of information on gun issues there. I'm pretty proud of the information we put together on concealed carry and these other debates about mass shootings and assault weapons and other regulations. So just crimeresearch.org.
Simple enough, crimeresearch.org. And if you need to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, you can do that as well as we continue to approach another milestone with so many people beginning to do that. Just go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. The icons for that you will find in the upper right-hand corner. Back with your calls with Mr. John Lott on Coast to Coast AM.